From the Altoa Marine Corps Air Station in Santa Ana, California, this is Marine Gunnery Sergeant Bob Vandywalker doing a historical taped interview with Lance Corporal Larry A. Taylor, serial number 237-5765, MOS 0331. At present, Lance Corporal Taylor is working Provost Marshal office at the Air Facility in Santa Ana. Lance Corporal Taylor, on this tape, I'd like to start off with when you arrived in Vietnam, where you arrived, where you were sent, and as much in detail as you can remember of your tour in Vietnam, bringing out as many experiences your unit had or yourself. And if possible, try to bring out names of people, COs and so forth. So, go ahead.
We arrived at Da Nang on the 1st of February, I believe it was, and we laid overnight there. The following morning, we flew on to Phu Bai. We had been attached that morning to our different units, myself being attached to 1st Battalion, 26 Marines. We then flew on to Phu Bai, where we were to be dispersed to our permanent station there. I arrived at Phu Bai, and it took us a week from there to get on to Khe San. In that time, I more or less got familiarized with the weather in the area of Vietnam, which was, of course, quite strange, and I suppose as everybody had, you're a little scared as to what to expect. But from there we went on to Khe San, which at the time everybody was talking about as being one of the worst places in Vietnam.
Let me interject here, Corporal Taylor. Did you fly to Khe San or what? How'd they get you up there, and how large a group?
They took us, there were 12 of us and our cargo on a C-123, one of the last ones that were allowed flown into Khe San before the airstrip was closed for planes. I believe there were just 10 of us, and all of our gear and as much supplies as they could get on the plane for the men at Khe San. When we arrived there, they sent us to our different company headquarters. There at the headquarters, they put myself in Delta Company 126, and we were escorted on down because of course, the unfamiliarity with the area and the type of attack that they were constantly under. We were personally escorted to each of our units, where I was introduced to my CO and the men on down the line, clear down to my fire team leader, and assigned a bunker and given instructions. It just so happened that I was supposed to have 2 to 3 days to get to know the area, my duties, to walk the posts with a few of the other men, just to get to better know what my duties would be and to be able to perform them a little better. But it just so happened that the following day we came under our Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 26 Marines Bravo Company, went on a 400 meter sweep outside the perimeter and were hit in a very large ambush. In fact, they were just about completely wiped out. They had to leave 50 in the field and brought 20 dead back with them.
Were you with them?
No, I was with Delta Company, and we were called down on the lines because we were expecting a large follow-through, ground attack, which fortunately never came. So from then on, I was right in it. There was no period of familiarization or anything else. From then on, I was standing duty and performed the duties as all the other men.
In other words, you were very green. What previous training had you had before you went to Vietnam?
Nothing but infantry training, regiment, and basic infantry training and staging.
When you flew from Da Nang into Khe San, what did you have? Did you have your flak jacket and everything?
Right, we had all our gear except for ammunition for the rifle.
Who issued you this gear?
This was issued from our battalion rear at Phu Bai.
In other words, you got off at Fubai?
Right, we laid over in Fubai. Well, it took almost a week because the flights were so scarce getting into Quezon. It took us almost a full week in order to get on a flight that actually made it. We did take off one day, and they were under real heavy arty attack, and we had to go on. We swung south to Da Nang and stayed overnight there, and then the next day went back to Fubai and tried again.
How old are you, Corporal Taylor?
I'm 19 right now.
At that time, 18?
Right.
Now, did you hear at that time when you were in Fubai the problems that they were having at Quezon or anything?
You heard varied stories. Of course, this being the rear, we had the men coming back from R&R. We had the men coming back from Quezon ready to go home. And we also had the green ones, like myself, waiting to go. And we heard varied type of stories, all of it sounding very bad, of course, but everything... from it was the worst place in Vietnam to it wasn't so bad as long as you kept your head down. So you sort of had mixed emotions as to what to believe, and I tried to make it a habit not to believe anything until I saw it for myself. But I know that they told us all sorts of stories.
You were pretty scared when you got on an airplane, I imagine, like any normal Marine. I mean, you were...
not scared getting on. Getting off, yes.
Okay, let's go through the procedure then of what happened when you came at Quezon then with this aircraft.
I wasn't at all worried until we got to the position where they told us we were starting to start our descent. The pilot started flying a diversive pattern, swinging back and forth across the runway. And at that time we could hear the incoming artillery blasting around the area, and you could see the explosions. And from that time on, I think all of us were a little apprehensive as to what was going to happen once we got off that plane in the middle of nowhere, really. And you could see actually, up until this time, every place in Vietnam I'd seen had hooches, tents, or buildings.
Something above the ground, you mean?
Right. And here, it just looked barren. And we were going to land here. On touchdown, it was the quickest a group of men ever got off the plane I've ever seen in my life. We touched down, the tailgate of the plane was open, the gear was dropped immediately, and we followed it off, and the plane was still taxiing. It never stopped. And the only thing they told us was keep going and head for a deep hole and get there until somebody comes and tells you to move, which they didn't have to tell us. We pretty well picked that up ourselves.
In other words, you jumped off the airplane while everybody jumped off while he was moving along with the gear, came off, and so
right.
forth.
We followed the gear right off and headed right straight for the trench line. And once we were in the trench line, we were pinned down for about 5 minutes until the airplane had left the strip and the incoming had slowed down or more or less ceased. And then they told us to one by one go out and pick up our gear and start dispersing in no groups. Spread out, well spread out to our different battalion or different company areas to find out more about.
What was the general location of your company as far as where you had to walk and so forth?
Well, I had to walk clear from the one end of the base to the other. And it just didn't seem right walking on the road, but I didn't know. In fact, actually, we didn't know where we were going. We had to keep asking other Marines along the way. But it didn't seem like a real nice place the first day there.
When you say you walk on a road, long side the airstrip or what? How did this work now?
Well, the airstrip was positioned approximately 150 meters off the road that led down towards the area with just side roads going on to it. And we followed a first sergeant down. He told us he'd lead us down there, and he walked right down the side of the road, so we just decided we should follow him. We didn't know any better way, so.
Well, as you were going by each other Marines, were they dug in and so forth?
No, this is one thing I found about Quezon. They were so used to the attacks, the artillery attacks, and mortar, and rocket, that they got to be sort of, I don't know if it was foolishly brave or daredevilish or what, but as soon as an attack had ceased, the rounds had slowed down, the men immediately came out of their hiding positions and went right back to work. They were just used to it. After a while there, I learned myself, you can tell incoming from outgoing, And when you hear it, you know it's time to get down. When you don't hear it anymore, the work's got to be done. They got up and done it. Did it. Got it done. And there was... It seemed foolish at first. I just couldn't see walking around in that area with the artillery rounds. You never knew when to expect them.
Well, here's a question I'd like to ask you. I never ask anybody on historical tape from Quezon. You rode home while you were in Quezon, home to your family and friends. Did you have a tendency to be quiet about what was happening, or did you exploit a little bit deep into the problems you had?
Well, I've got very understanding parents, and I told them definitely not to believe what was in the newspapers and what was on the television, because this, to me, was magnified for sensationalism purposes of selling their papers and getting viewers for their television programs. I told them as much as I could the straight facts, censoring myself on items that I thought might be pertinent, but I told them as straight as possible what exactly was going on and the situation we were in. And I tried to, as much as possible, discredit the television and newspapers, because I felt they were using sensationalism to an extent.
Well, the only trouble is, though, with television, it was actually happened. I can see newspapers, but some of the shots they took, for example, were, you can't lie on television. Did you feel...
Well, that's true, but you can always show the worst.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I felt they were doing. Of course, this is their job. But it worries parents very much. They were much more worried than I was.
But on their return letters, were they beginning an understanding? No, I guess you can't say that, but they were still, you were their son, and they certainly were concerned with you. But did they write understanding letters in this respect?
I think, my father did. See, my mother was married twice. Her first husband was killed in World War II in the Marines. And I'm her youngest son, and it made it very bad to have me overseas, the first one in combat. And
at Quezon.
Right, at Quezon. So it was pretty hard for her to understand anything except that I was in combat and not home. But I think that she realized that it was just a job that I had to do, and that, God willing, I'd be home fine.
Mm-hmm.
So it worked out fairly well.
Okay, well, let's go to your unit now. You went to this particular unit, and what happened then? After you found what you were assigned to a particular job in a squad or what?
Right. When I primarily went over as an 0311 infantry, regular infantry man. And at the time, they were very short of machine gunners. They said, we need machine gunners. You are a machine gunner. And of course, at first, this bothered me, because all the way through all my infantry training, they told me the machine gunner's position is bad because they're the first ones to get it in any type of an ambush or combat because of the firepower they're putting out. But they then sent me and put me in with billeted me with one of the other guys in the squad. And right away I learned that everybody there was more or less like one big family, because they were all working together doing the same job. They were very friendly. They took time out from their regular duties to explain the gun to me, tear it down in front of me, and show me the parts and teach me how it works. Although at the present time I was only carrying ammunition. And it took very little time at all for me to really get to know the guys and get to be just part of their family. It was a month and a half before I started carrying the gun myself. Well, there was no need to, really, because we never went outside of Quezon. But, like I say, the second day was a little exciting. I was there with 8 magazines, and one of them filled with ammunition and no other, and we got what I felt was an attack, and I had no ammunition, and they couldn't seem to find any for me. So I was supposed to go down on lines and help man the lines.
Was this for your machine gun?
No, this was for my M16, because I was A-gunning at the time, just carrying ammunition. And I didn't really understand that job either, but they were so short of men, they just said, you're going to have to learn one way or the other. So they couldn't find ammunition for me, so finally I just walked up and told the lieutenant that I was improperly equipped and I didn't feel that I should go on lines this way. And he gave me 200 of his rounds off his shoulders himself and told me to try to make that do. And after that first day, things more or less, it was a fast way to get broken in, because we received some, I believe it was 1,100 rounds that day, incoming rounds. And that was the only day I can really say that it had me worried. You'd hear the whistling overhead and the explosions, and at first, when it's the first time you undergo something like this, it does bother you. You don't know where they're going or how close they are or anything else.
In other words, you say it bothered you because it was your first time.
Right. After that, it didn't take long at all. Maybe it was because of the amount of rounds we were receiving, but it didn't take long to be able to identify an incoming round from our outgoing from Camp Carroll and the surrounding bases that we had. And as soon as you heard that, it was get down, you heard the whistle go overhead, and that's all there was to it. You stayed down until the explosions were more or less over, and I don't know, I never worried. Maybe, well, I'm foolish, but I never really worried.
You said you moved out. Now, where did you move out as far as where you were living? Up on top of the plateau of Quezon, or where was this at?
When we moved out on operation?
Mm-hmm.
We moved out, this is when the 101st Airborne came in to replace us. All the Marines at the base moved up Route 1 North and made a sweep. We hit hills 589, 758, the one that I got hit on, which is the beginning of the 861 ridgeline. Then they followed the 861 ridgeline west, I believe it was, northwest, towards Quan Tri. After I got hit, I can't really tell you where they went, because for a week and a half's time, I was completely out of contact with them. I didn't get a chance to keep up on them at all. And the next thing I knew was when I was talking to one of the other guys that had gotten hit in an ambush and was sent to the same hospital I was, and he told me that they were then in Quan Tri. But between the time I got hit and then, I don't have any idea of what happened to them, where they went, or anything else.
In other words, you were really at Quezon, what, about 2 months?
Right.
Now, this was supposed to be the real big siege at time.
Yes, it was.
What did your days consist of there then? In other words, you didn't stay, did you go out on a lot of patrols out of Quezon?
No, there were very few. In the 2 months that I was there, I don't think there was over a half a dozen patrols. Mainly because there were, at times when I first got there, we were told that there was a force of some 35 to 40,000 North Vietnamese regulars surrounding the base, and they were close enough that we didn't dare go outside the gate for anything, outside the wire. The lines were constantly manned. The day that our Bravo company got hit so bad, they found where the Vietnamese had a trench line that came in within 150 meters of our outside perimeter, trench line and tunnel network. And as it was written up in the papers, they believed they were trying to make another Dien Bien Phu out of this, where they had dug in completely underneath them and came up right in the middle of them.
But were they dug in as far as you knew about it?
Yes, they were. They definitely were dug in.
This was on the north side, more so, north west side, or what side?
Yeah, I believe it was. They had about 2.5 sides. Trench lines on 2.5 sides and completely connected by underground tunnels. My own company, Delta Company, went out on one operation, one patrol. Our main objective was to sweep through an area and destroy all tunnels, networks, and trench lines, and open that area up and clear it out because it was supposed to be heavily concentrated. This was just approximately 2 or 3 weeks before we moved out, and they felt that it was the manpower of the Vietnamese had dropped down enough that we dared do this. And everybody in the company carried 8 grenades. This was the order. Everybody in the company would carry 8 grenades. And there were very few guys that came back with any. And those that did just had 1 or 2.
What did they use them for?
We were using them for blowing the spider holes and underground tunnels.
You were running into a lot of spider holes, though.
They were everywhere.
Did you run into any NVA at all?
Very few. They did find a few in the trench lines and in the spider holes. But there were very few. I don't know if they saw us coming or what, but they just moved on to a different area. But we ran into very few. Those that were there, for some reason, possibly just stragglers or scouts. But I believe our whole company got 14 confirmed.
Lance Corporal Taylor, something I'd like to ask you also. Now, did you lose any men at all in your company or in Quezon?
Yes. In Quezon itself, when we were there, we lost 1, 2, 3 men. That is all that I know of.
Killed or how about wounded people?
There were quite a few wounded. There were always men picking up a piece of shrapnel from the incoming.
But not evacuated, though?
Not very often serious enough for evacuation.
What I was getting around to was, did you see new men come in like yourself? Was there many Marines coming in like yourself that green has just come out
of? No. There was, I believe, 2 more planes that brought in new men. After that, the runway was closed to all airplanes other than 123s. And no new troops were coming in. They didn't feel it was safe enough to chance the lives of all the men plus the expensive plane to bring them in.
Well, they had lost some planes then when you were there.
Right. They lost
the C-130, the helicopter.
The C-130, there was a C-130 that got hit about the first week I was there. It was taken off. It got hit with a mortar round on one wing and crashed.
What about the one that burned? Didn't one come in burn there right on?
Right. That one burnt in the middle of the strip, and they had to drag that off. There were numerous ones that were lost, helicopters and 123s and 130s. That's why they shut it down for the 130s. They didn't feel they were fast enough to make the landing and drops and get away again. In fact, the 123s were even instructed to make airdrops. They'd come down to within about 2 foot of the runway, open their tailgate, and do a quick straight up in the air and never actually touch down and dump the gear on the runway and just keep going.
Were you there when I think it was a C-130 dropped their gear in the wrong place? They went over. Do you remember this?
By parachute?
Yes.
They've done that. I don't know how wrong place you're talking about, but I know they did have quite a bit of trouble hitting the drop zone. I don't know why, possibly because it was all coverage, trees, and jungle until all of a sudden that drop zone was right there. But it was many times the guys had to go out, which it wasn't far. The drop zone was inside the wire, and they'd have to go just maybe 100, 150 meters outside the wire to pick up articles that hadn't landed within the wire.
Did any of your unit get involved in this?
No, we weren't at all involved with this. This was, I believe, attached to the supply organization did this. They had
shore party people, probably, huh?
I couldn't really say.
Well, look, here's something I wanted. Maybe you can help me out. I've never brought it in. I've been trying to bring it into the tape. Now, they were setting up machine guns where the planes were taking off. In other words, trying to hit the belly of these planes.
Right.
Who was actually scouting this particular area? What the organization? Do you know? Are you familiar at all with this?
Not really. This is one reason it kind of fooled all of us, too. All of a sudden, the airplanes started coming in from the opposite direction and dropping down over the top of these machine guns, dropping down and rising again on the opposite end of the runway. They had there were 3 50 caliber machine guns that they knew of in the area. Of course, we had constant spotter planes flying the area. And every time, in fact, once in a while, they would use a helicopter with a cargo load as a decoy with about four or five spotter planes and numerous other choppers using it, working as spotters to try to get the North Vietnamese to open fire on the one chopper so that they could spot the position. But it didn't seem to do any good. Every time they spotted the position, they would artillery it and throw mortars at it until they were blue in the face, and the next day it would pop up a little off to a different direction.
Well, what on your patrols, particular patrols, what direction did you go? How far away from Khe Sanh, or did you stay right around the area, maybe 100 meters or so?
No, when we went, like I say, this was to the time where they didn't feel that there was over possibly 10 or 15,000 Vietnamese around the base. And this particular area we were going through, they felt was fairly secure, other than possibly the remainder of a battalion that had moved to a different location on the base. They sent us out 800 meters, 800 to 1,000 meters. And the main purpose, like I say, was to blow their spider holes so that they couldn't be used again if they decided to move back into the area.
Well, didn't you feel this is quite a long ways out? What direction was this, by the way?
It was northwest, if I'm correct.
Towards 881 or towards...
Right. Yes, out towards 881. At that time, we had slowed down to an average of possibly 100 incoming rounds a day to maybe 150 at the most. So we felt they were either running low of supplies or had been moving out because they had decided there was no way they were going to take the base. So really, we didn't feel too apprehensive about going out. We felt that we were going to run into more action than what we did.
And did you run into action?
Very little resistance at all, other than the few that we found still in their spider holes or working the trench line. Like I say, there was just 14 confirmed that we got. So I don't really know what happened to them or where they went, of course. It's hard to try to keep track of them.
What was the feeling of the Marines when the Army 101st was coming up there? Did you actually have a chance to meet these fellows? Did they contact you where they came inside the perimeter?
Yes, we did. They moved in around 0500 in the morning, and we moved out at about 0600. So in this hour's time, they were taking over our bunkers and setting up their placements and getting the lines manned while we were moving out and preparing to leave the base itself.
How did they come in?
They came in from three different directions.
Well, they dropped by helicopter, that's what I meant.
No, they were flown by helicopter north to, I believe it was about 5 miles south of us. And from there, they came in on foot. They sat in the night before on the base of 950 and 1015. And where the rest of those were the ones we could see. Where the rest of them were, I don't know. And then early the next morning, they moved on into base.
When you got a chance to talk to them, did they have much trouble coming in there?
No, they said they'd met very little resistance, but of course they brought 30,000 troops with them. This is what we were told, in a way, that there were 30,000 Army personnel moving in. And this is a pretty large number to give too much resistance to.
Well, what was the idea for that, then? Where were the Marines supposed to go, for example, your particular unit?
The main objective of the Operation Pegasus that we moved out on was to get the road opened up so it was clear for our own use. And once we got it opened up, after that it was tentative as to what we were to do, whether to move to Da Nang, go afloat, move over by Cameron Bay, just more or less take it easy, because the 26 Marines and its attachments had been going pretty strong for quite a while. Or it was possible, we had heard that it was possible we were moving straight into another heavily fortified area to help out more Marines. But at the time, the main objective was to get the road opened up for our own purposes and the Army's purposes, and after that, we'd receive more orders as to what would follow.
Well, we in the Marine Corps have this old spirit de corps. Did you feel that this Army unit was a pretty good unit?
No.
They didn't operate like us?
I felt that we could have used the men a lot earlier. We could have used their helicopters. They brought in more fighter helicopters in one day than we'd seen at that base the whole time I was there. They brought in 30,000 Army troops to replace 6,000 Marine troops. And it, in fact, what really hurt, I guess, the most was that the night that they were close enough that we could see them, they had one of their helicopters fly us ice cream. They had it flown over to us and donated it to us. And that, it, I don't know, for some reason it turned most of the guys against the Army.
You mean they felt the Marines should have done that, in other words?
No, it was just that it hurt to know that they've got so much and we had so little at the time. They had the means to get the ice cream and the milk and they even had hot chow flown to one of the units. I'm not sure which one. And we'd been for 2 months living on one sea rat a day and a third a canteen of water and didn't even know what a bath looked like anymore. And it just didn't seem right that they should be eating hot chow and having ice cream every day. It just didn't
Well, let's
seem
turn
right
this out. Around. Do you feel that the Army troops had respect for the Marines that were there?
Yes, I do. They had the respect more so when they moved in and had talked to us. While we were waiting to move out, we were talking to the guys that were moving into our bunker. And they were very surprised that we had dug our own bunkers and fortified them as well as we had by ourselves without the help of the Seabees or some engineering battalion. Because they were very good bunkers. They would withstand quite a lot of direct hits of small rockets even before they were to the extent that you'd have to worry about getting injured inside. And we did this all ourselves, and after talking to them and explaining it to them, I think we gained a very big respect from them because they were used to moving into a place and if it wasn't already dug, have somebody dig it for them, which they told us straight out. And they had yet, this was the farthest north they had been. They weren't familiar with the terrain or anything else and they found it quite different. And they were pretty displeased. They were hoping that it wasn't going to re-strengthen up to the position as it was the way it was before we had moved out, about the middle of the siege.
Okay, let's go on from there and go into, you left the position, then what happened? You fellas took off to go someplace. Can you explain? You already said what their plans were. Now, you left and then you ran into some problems. Can you explain this story?
Well, when we moved out, We moved out about 6 in the morning. We moved very slowly. This was the first real movement I'd been on. And I liked it. I enjoyed it because I always had the feeling that if I'm going to fight, I'd like to be able to see what I'm fighting and not just have to duck these incoming rounds. We moved out very slowly. Very spread out at first. The first day, I believe it was Hill 589. It was just 3,000 meters, I believe. Yes, 3,000 meters out of the caisson area was where we sat in. On 589, we dug in all the way around it. Met no resistance at all that night. The next morning, they decided to have us lay over. They were awaiting instructions as to exactly which direction to go or something. I'm not sure exactly what they were waiting for. So we dug in a little better. We made a sweep from there, just a squad-sized patrol to check out the area for any booby traps or personnel mines, any type of harassment we might run into when we moved out. We ran into no problems there. The following day we moved out again. The whole, our battalion, of course, was moving. The whole 26 Marines with its attachments were on the move, but of course I was familiar only with what our own battalion was doing and which direction they were going. When we moved out, moved on down the road, we ran into no opposition all day, but that night we did receive a few rounds, very few, which we were pretty surprised at. Actually, we ran into nothing all the whole time that I lasted with them on this operation, up until the day that I got hit, when we moved up the beginning of the 861 ridgeline, sat on top of 758. We completed the perimeter. We had from 12 till 3 o'clock position around the hill. The others had already set in. We were the last group of men there, and they had received a few rounds. There had been three men, I believe, killed that we helped load on the choppers from mortar rounds. So we did expect a little bit. And we sat in, we dug in real well. They started dropping supplies and choppers bringing in supplies. It looked like we were going to spend a few days there. In fact, I found out later that they did spend 5 days on 758 and met minor resistance, never a ground attack, just mortars. But we sat in there, we dug in real well. About 7:30 in the evening was when we, or about 6 o'clock is when we hit the top of the hill and started setting in. About 7:30, it was starting to get dusk, and this is when they dropped that one lone mortar round in on my machine gun bunker and got my team leader and myself. After that, what happened to the battalion, I don't really know.
Have you any idea what the size of the unit was that was hitting you?
No, I don't. Nor did these. I tried to find out as much as possible as soon as I had the occasion to talk to one of the other fellows that was with me, that happened to be sent to the same hospital in Guam that I was at. And he said they never did find out. They received just 4 or 5 other rounds all night, and then the rest of the time they're there, they just receive sporadic fire once in a while, but nothing that they could trace because they kept moving. They sent out squad-sized patrols or company-sized patrols, something like this, maybe a platoon, but they could never find them. And after that, they moved out, and they did get hit real bad, just southeast, I believe it was, of Quan Tri. And they got hit real, real bad, I understand. And in fact, my whole battalion was practically what they considered wiped out, below effective fighting strength.
Have you any idea, now you lay there wounded, how much trouble it was to get a helicopter to get you evacuated?
Yes, I do. I know it was very much trouble because the hill we were on was high enough up that the clouds were beginning to set down on top of us. And besides that, it was dusk and starting to get dark. They were afraid they wouldn't be able to get a chopper in until the next morning. But the situation was, myself, I had about 15 holes in me, and my team leader looked like he'd been shot with a shotgun at close range. He had 51 holes in him, I found out later when we got to the hospital. And he was bleeding real bad, and they told him it was extreme emergency, they'd get a chopper in there. And they never would have gotten one in, except that there happened to be one in the area just coming back from a medevac. And they radioed him, and he dropped in about 5 minutes later. And at that time, it was pretty dark, and we had to light a flare in order for him to find where to land, because it was getting dark.
Was there only two of you wounded then that was getting aboard the truck?
Right. There's just the two of us out of our bunker.
After you're back here and have a chance to evaluate all this, what is your feeling towards these helicopters?
I think that helicopter and the men that pilot them are really great. They do a wonderful job, and they've got a big job to do over there. And I'll never put down a helicopter pilot or the choppers themselves.
After you got home, now we were talking about letters being written, or after you were possibly in the hospital, what was your family's feeling then, maybe writing letters or talking to them?
Well, I called them as soon as I got to Guam Naval Hospital. It was pretty good to talk to them, of course. And due to the fact that my mother had lost a husband there in the war, Second World War, At first, I tried to minimize my wounds as much as possible and gradually let her know what had really happened. But they were pretty concerned, of course. In fact, as I understand it, my dad said my mother would have been to Guam if she could have afforded it, but they were real apprehensive as to the condition I was in. I had Red Cross, who was another real great organization. The ones working out of Guam do an awful lot for the guys. They sent a notice from the doctor stating just what my wounds were and the extent of my wounds.
Did your folks say that any Marine officer or any Marine had visited their home to let you know that they were wounded?
No, this was due to the fact that when I had first gone to Dong Ha, I had requested that they not be notified, and therefore they weren't. I was the first one that to let them know, which I felt would be a lot better. I knew they were shipping me out of Vietnam, so I asked them not to notify my parents, and that I'd get in touch with them as soon as possible.
Well, you said when you went to Dong Ha, did somebody talk to you about this? What was the procedure then?
I talked to them the first morning. We got there about 8:30 in the evening. We went directly in the operating room. And when I woke up the next morning, I talked to one of the doctors, and he said he'd arranged to have the papers filled out to request that they not be notified.
Oh, while you were laying there wounded, I meant. That's when you did.
Right. So he had the papers all filled out and sent in so that they wouldn't be notified.
But the procedure was, at one particular place, one or the other, that they would have papers where you could let your folks notify, not only yourself, but anybody.
Correct.
It was up to the discretion of the individual. Now, some of these kids naturally were wounded much worse than they realized, and they would probably notify the parents.
Right. It's when you first go over, of course, you fill out who you want notified in case of you're being wounded. And here that you have the opportunity, if you wish, to put down not to notify your parents due to reasons, personal or medical, anything else. But most of the guys do list their parents. But for some reason, after I got hit, I felt that it would be better if I got a chance to talk to them first, and I knew that I was going away from Vietnam, that I would probably be able to get a chance to do this. And that's the reason I requested that they not be notified.
Well, Lance Corporal Taylor, thank you very much. And from the Altoa Marine Corps Air Station, this is Marine Gunnery Sergeant Bob Vandywalker interviewing Lance Corporal Larry A. Taylor, Historical Tape Program for Headquarters Marine Corps.